Welcome to Sky Talkers. Here are your hosts, Charlotte and Caitlin.
Hello, and welcome to Sky Talkers. I'm your host, Charlotte.
Hey, everyone. I'm your other host, Caitlin, and welcome to this week's Bad Batch discussion, where we're talking all about episodes 10, Identity Crisis, and episode 11, Point of No Return. And y'all, I don't know how I'm still alive after these episodes. It, particularly episode 11, just kind of totally wrecked me.
That for me, episode 10 actually wrecked me.
I mean, they both did, don't get me wrong, but the tension, the action of episode 11, I was literally, they were very different types of tension, right? Like, I think episode 10 is that quiet, science-y tension of, you know, finding out what's in the vault. It's children. Oh my God.
What the vault is.
Yeah. You know, like, it's this awful realization. But then the other awful part of it is that it's just continuing quietly in this imperial vault on Tantus. Whereas in episode 11 is the, are they going to find Omega? The action of it all. The, you know, they're being chased. The cat and mouse of it. So very different types of tension. But man, episode 11, I was like, whoa, they hate this show.
I know. Okay, so if we can back up a little bit. Last week we had an episode titled The Harbinger. Mm-hmm. We talked a little bit about that title. It's very clear that now this is the pivot point for like that the Harbinger.
The point of no return.
If we want to just
one minute.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Like, if we want to go by the titles, like, The Harbinger really changed the tone of these episodes until the finale,
yes.
I think. If we just want to, like, separate the story and everything from that episode of The Harbinger, wow, we are really in it. We are here. The tone that is set for Identity Crisis, episode 10 specifically, is kind of masterful, honestly. And it didn't even really occur to me until the end of the episode that this is one that we don't see Omega and the Bad Batch crew. I was so locked in.
Yeah.
Almost within the first 10 minutes, we find out the answers to questions that we've had for a while, too.
We were talking last week about, I think it'll be the ninth hour that we find out about Project Necromancer. And literally episode 10, 2 minutes in, Hemlock is spelling it all out for us.
I say this a lot, but The Bad Batch as a series does this a lot. They answer questions right away, sometimes quicker than I think they should.
Yeah.
Honestly.
I kind of rewound that part going, wait a second. Wait. Did we just,
just went over this really fast.
We got it. Okay.
Yeah. And then it makes me think, okay, as a fandom, are we just really concerned with these questions, or is the story begging us to be concerned with these questions?
I think this question, it's begging us to be concerned because Omega is begging to know what's going on.
Right.
Yeah. I will say, just as a bit of a disclaimer, we did receive another set of screeners of episodes 10 through 14. So we have seen, just before we dive into the conversation.
That's not the finale, by the way.
It is not
what
the finale.
What we haven't seen is the finale.
Yeah. Yeah. So I know last week we talked about being at the end of our screeners, and then literally the next day they sent the next batch of the Bad Batch screeners. So we have seen episodes 10 through 14 at this time, but like always, we will not discuss what's happening later on in the season. So, you know, just our typical disclaimer there, but we did get to watch episodes 10 and 11 early, about a week early. And I'm so ready to see people's reactions to these episodes because I truly was wrecked by the end of both. And I tweeted this, but I had to take a break between episodes 11 and 12. I was like, I need to decompress a little bit after what has just happened.
And I definitely stared at the ceiling for like 30 minutes.
Yeah. it was, we'll get into it, of course.
Okay, episode 10, Identity Crisis, was directed by Saul Ruiz and written by Amanda Rose Muniz. So this episode, let's dive into it. What are your thoughts? What was your reaction really with it?
Holocron
and
heist.
What did you think about it?
Holocron heist.
Oh my God.
We're always bringing back the holocron heist.
Let's start there. Caitlin, expand on the holocron heist lore that you have woven throughout our podcast for 7 years.
I'm the only one talking about Holocaust. I don't know. That's not true. But we do bring it up a lot because it's season two Clone Wars. I think it's the season opener. I can't remember. But Cad Bane, he's stealing a holocron from the Jedi archives that has a list of all the force sensitive children. And it's this huge thing. We see Palpatine creepily hanging over the crib of a force sensitive baby back in season two of the Clone Wars. It's a great Anakin and Ahsoka episode for the two of them. You know, it's only season two, so they haven't even been master and apprentice very long. Cad Bane captures Ahsoka and Anakin has to save her. There's some great lines from Ahsoka to Cad Bane, like, I know my master's going to come for me. And Cad Bane is like, yeah, I'm literally counting on it. And I bring that up because I kind of got similar vibes from Omega at the end of like, I know my crew is going to come for me. So like I can give myself up like this, you know, which she's always maintained that kind of similar feeling about the Bad Batch, obviously. But that's why I bring that. But yeah, I feel like Holocron Heist, this idea of capturing force sensitive children has been a running theme throughout all of Star Wars, and it comes up a lot. So now to really kind of fully bring it back with Cad Bane here is kind of incredible, honestly, to see that he's still doing this, that he's the one to call when you want to capture a force sensitive child. And it's literally been true for like a decade now in the Star Wars in the universe Star Wars timeline. So
yeah, like there's a reason why Cad Bane was in this episode. Mm-hmm. And we should have, I didn't realize that Cad Bane was going to be in the Bad Batch until we were talking to Star Wars Explained last week. I, for some reason, completely missed him in the trailer that was released before the season started. And if I had known that, we would have been speculating that that was the reason why Cad Bane was back, because it just makes sense. And it's something we've talked about before. Yeah. And I love the concept of, okay, they're in the writer's room for the Bad Batch, talking about how they need to tell the story about Force-sensitive children and the Empire exploiting them. And they need to fill in a piece of how is the Empire getting these children. And in comes whoever suggests Holocron Heist as the linking point and bringing Cad Bane back for just like this bit is just perfect. And maybe it was Dave. I don't know. I need to know more. But also, if we just want to take another step back, this beginning of this episode was actually devastating. I could not handle it. And I think that it really teetered on the drama that was almost like borderline maybe too scary for kids. And this goes back to my my question of like from the beginning of the season of who is the primary audience of The Bad Batch as a series. And sometimes I'm like, it's kids. And sometimes I'm like, it's teens. And sometimes I'm like, it's me, you know?
Yeah.
And I think in this one, it's like, oh, it's me. It's us, yeah. Right? It's our age group who is aware of all this. But sometimes I just can't really believe that we're getting this story out of this show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, incredibly dark. And, you know, we've seen Cad Bane in The Bad Batch before. You know, he's been after Omega, which I'm sure we talked about Holocron Heist then as well.
Yeah, we did.
Sure we did. We bring it up all the time. Sorry about it. But yeah, they really did a good job of just depicting how dark the whole thing is. Even when Cad Bane is talking to Emery, when he's dropping off the latest child specimen, as they say in the show, and he's talking about, you know, all the others, basically. And or what is it? Sorry. Emery asks, how many other children have you brought in, because there's only three in the vault at when she gets into the vault. And Cad Bane says this great line after Emery asks about, you know, how many other children have you brought in, and he says something along the lines of you give away more than you think by asking a question like that. And he's definitely talking about her compassion for the specimens, but it really does beg the question of how many other children have been brought in like this? And to your point, Charlotte, with the Inquisitors of, you know, some of these specimens are being eliminated and then some are being brought in to be tested like this. But there's also, it feels like there have also been children who have been brought into the vault that are not there anymore. So where are they? And it's just, it's incredibly dark. And I think we should have known that this is what was inside the vault, because if that's what they're doing with Omega, everything tracks with, you know, everything we've seen in the Holocron heist thread, you know, going all the way up to Grogu, that it would be children that they would be doing this experimentation on.
Oh my gosh, I'm so glad you brought up Grogu. Even what they put the little baby in.
Oh, the pram.
That was the pram that the Mandalorian found Grogu in. Mm-hmm. And I'm just like, oh my God, the connections, the implications.
Yeah.
There is that connection. And I think it's, again, just to back up and say, I'm just really, I can't believe we're getting this story. And it feels like we're filling in a lot of gaps that we've been thinking about for a long time
with
this show. But still, it feels so focused on Omega and her own journey, even though this episode doesn't even have Omega in it. Mm-hmm. So it feels, I don't know. I think this is just like a feat of good writing and good direction.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, so let's talk about Omega and what actually is happening in the vault. We get basically a little brief from Hemlock about what is going on, the questions we've all been asking, and you and I in particular have been very confused about with what is the M count situation with Omega. And here's the direct quote from Hemlock himself. He said, "These particular three were selected because of their high M count. They're unaware of why they're here and what they possess. As you know, M count cannot be directly replicated from the source. However, Nala Se knew of another way, which is why she aided in Omega's escape. The young clone's blood is the only binder that's proven compatible with their DNA to recreate their M count levels, and why Omega must be found. Testing should proceed as planned." Now, I get it, but I still don't really kind of get
it. Okay, same. So glad you said that. So let's walk through it. Okay. First, there's a couple things here. Okay. This is a big paragraph of text and exposition that was just dropped. Okay. If I could have a complaint, it's probably this, but also I'm a big girl. I can figure it out, you know?
Okay. All right. Let's figure it out. Right.
Let's figure it out. First thing that I want to call out is I think it's interesting that Hemlock says that the kids there are unaware why they're here and what they possess. What they possess is interesting, meaning that they don't know that they're force sensitive. They don't know that they have a high midichlorian count. They don't know what they are capable of. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if that's going to have something, like we're going to see that later. Don't know. Second, I think Omega, the way I understand it, we learned that Omega isn't innately force sensitive, but her blood can replicate the M count. So they can add...
If they add Omega's blood.
Different. If they add the kid's blood to Omega's blood, it can sustain the amount of midichlorians that the kids already have naturally.
No, I think it's about replication.
In what way?
So I think so. All right, let me see.
No, this is very important.
Okay. Okay. Here's what I think happened. So I think when they take a sample from like Jax, one of the kids, right? And they go to clone it, just like they can clone people now, right? They go to clone it. The clone of Jax's blood does not have a high M count. It's not force sensitive. So it's not a 1-to-1. But when they take Jax's blood and then they, or DNA, and they, it's because I guess the M count is in the DNA rather than the blood. But then when they put the DNA into Omega's blood and clone it.
Do you think they're just saying DNA because they don't want to say blood? Oh, they did
no,
say they, blood.
No. I don't think, okay, again, who's the audience? We can say blood. When they put Omega's blood with the DNA, then it can be cloned and keep that M count, that high M count. So hers is the binder that makes it, I guess that protects the M count from being depleted or destroyed in the cloning process. It's like a protectant is what I think.
Okay. So the thing that I am taking away from this is I get that And I see why Omega is the missing piece. Like, what happened in this conversation that Hemlock says is that here's why Omega is important, because she is crucial in the M count replication, whatever, right? Yes. And I still don't think that that is, I think that Star Wars is being intentionally confusing and vague so that they can fill it in later for things and stories like Palpatine and other cloning stories, right? Like, I think that we're not going to know the full scientific process. Like, say we would when we're watching Jurassic Park and they go through how they're able to make the dinosaurs by filling in the codes and everything. Like, we're not having Mr. DNA having a conversation here about what is going on with the dinosaur DNA, right? Like, we're just not doing that. We might later, I don't know, but I feel like there is an intentional vagueness here that we need to acknowledge, that what we're really getting away from this conversation is thematically that Omega is a missing piece, and the kids are also important because they also have natural Force-sensitive abilities, but Omega herself was not born with these natural abilities.
Yes, I agree. I think the takeaway is that Omega is not Force-sensitive, but that she can replicate Force sensitivity, or her blood can.
Correct.
But she needs that. It has to be with someone else who is Force-sensitive. I will say, though, I think this is pretty specific, actually, about the process. I mean, we're using words like binder and
it,
DNA.
It is specific. It is specific. But when you and I, 30-year-old plus women, right?
Thank you for the plus.
I'm 31. we're highly educated, right? Like, we're like a little confused.
Okay, but we're not science. We're liberal
we're
arts
science.
People.
We're liberal arts majors. Okay.
You're like, whatever. We're highly educated. Okay, we're liberal arts. But literally also, no, we're not.
Okay, thanks. You're so bad at math. It's fine. Okay.
Last week we were like, we can't follow the action. But yes.
Don't tell yourself short.
Understand, okay? The DNA cloning replication.
Like, there's a specificity here that is also vague. And I think that's paradoxical.
The thing that bring it back for us to like a moment of.
Yeah.
Do you remember learning the mitochondria, the DNA square dance?
Powerhouse of the...
DNA square dance about... No. It was like this video that we watched. You were there in middle school where they show the replication of DNA, and it's a square dance. And like when they take the X and Y chromosomes and everything, but it was like a little cartoon that they made it like a square dance. And it was a whole song, literally a song and dance situation. But that's what I think of every time we start talking about the DNA and the cloning and the replication and all of that. Mm-hmm. So, sorry, not really related, but just had to bring it up in case anyone else is familiar with the DNA square dance.
You're just really showing your cards that you haven't watched Jurassic Park in a really long time because you don't know the reference that I was talking about.
I knew it was a Jurassic Park reference.
The Mr. DNA of it all.
Yes.
Like, that's what you just described is that.
I know, but I also wanted to bring back my own reference to the square dance. But I was going to say, I think this season has been a record of how many times Charlotte can bring in Jurassic Park.
Well, it's, I think like, it's apt,
very
clearly one-to-one.
I think so, it's apt, but I just – your Jurassic Park references is becoming my Holocron Heist reference.
Totally. And what Holocron Heist is probably a better reference. Anyway.
No, they both work.
I feel like – yeah, obviously. They're both like ILM.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
I feel like, I don't know, let's move on from this. I think it's confusing, and we have answers, but we also don't.
Right.
I'm satisfied, but I'm also not. I don't think we're going to get a conclusion of, I don't think we're going to see like cloned Palpatine at the end of the series.
No, because the thing is, we know that in The Mandalorian, they still need someone like Grogu to...
Exactly
complete
what I mean.
These things. And you, I feel like this is really getting ahead, but you had put in our notes that it's been a minute since we've talked about the symbolism of Omega's name in general, of the Alpha and the Omega, the Omega being the end. So what is Omega the end of? And I think if we've been speculating that the finale, and as a reminder, we have not seen the finale, that the finale of all of this is leading us back to Tantus and freedom of the clones. And now that we know that the vault is with these children is all, are all here, the end of this experimentation, I think, is going to come from from Omega, and she's en route back to Tantis right now at the end of episode 11. So I think when we're thinking of that, the symbolism of her name, Omega, I think she is going to be in charge of the destruction of this testing facility, which is not just freeing the clones, but I imagine, you know, it's going to be the destruction of like the vault itself too.
Yeah, it's I think we're leading to something similar to the destruction of this as a station, and then maybe really setting the Empire back years and years in their scientific developments.
Yeah, I agree. Well, on that front, let's talk about what I kind of thought was a bit of a bombshell in this, in Identity Crisis, was this conversation between Tarkin and Hemlock, that Tarkin does not know what Project Necromancer is. Hemlock is above Tarkin on this. Can we appreciate that? Like, that is kind of crazy to me.
It's crazy. And it's also that, I think, lends credence to what we were just talking about, because Tarkin, by episode 4, right, is like second in command in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
How do we get to that point? We're not there yet with the Bad Batch in this timeline, but I don't...
He's really high up, yeah.
Yeah, I got to imagine that Hemlock is not part of this at all by that point. And
one can only hope.
Yeah, I mean, seriously, one can only hope. But like the fact that Tarkin doesn't know about it, the fact that Tarkin doesn't get the special treatment that Hemlock is getting from Palpatine, like the blank check, the whole like work on this, the pressure, everything. There has to be something that catastrophic that happens in the same way that what we see in Rogue One, right? So I feel like that's what we're leading to.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. And I just, the fact that the blank check that Palpatine gives Hemlock at the beginning of the season has kind of come back here into this episode and the conversation between Tarkin and Hemlock, I thought was a really great kind of continuation. Budgets, financial planning. It's important for the Empire. And the fact that the entire Empire is feeling the financial strain of Project Necromancer is also kind of wild. Like that's how many resources it's draining, because Hemlock knows that Palpatine, like he obviously knows what Palpatine wants from all of this. I would gather Hemlock knows that Palpatine wants to clone himself, or that could be in the works, a version of events, honestly. And the idea that he has the entire galaxy, pretty much every bounty hunter at his disposal looking for Omega specifically, is insane. And yeah, I think you're right. It's definitely going to be a, how are they going to recover from this? They can't just start up something like Project Necromancer again if in fact Tantis is fully destroyed, because it feels like they have all of their cloning scientific eggs in the Tantis basket. And one, because we know like something like the Zillow Beast is still here too. So there's a lot of money wrapped up in Tantis. And if it is destroyed, I don't know what they're going to do to build it again.
Well, they're just going to have to start from zero.
Yeah. Which, and I think Palpatine will tell them to do, but
totally. And we'll get to the point. It'll take forever.
Yeah.
To get us to the point where we're at with Grogu in The Mandalorian, which is after Return of the Jedi. So that's like, I'm really bad now with the timelines. I didn't used to be like this, but
like
I'm
15
at least
years.
10 years. Yeah. 15, 10 years later. So, I mean, 15 and 10 years is not super long in like a scientific community, right? Like if we want to think about it that way. But at the same time, like if all this gets destroyed and this is the end, as Omega's name symbolizes, of this project with the children and everything, at least here, because we know that they want to do the same thing to Grogu. I feel like that's what we're leading to, too.
Yeah.
But I just want to keep bringing up Omega's name symbolism, because I think it's interesting. We haven't talked about it in a while. The Alpha being the beginning, Omega being the end, the final. I know a lot of people have speculated maybe Omega dies in the end. And I don't believe that, but I think there's a different sort of end, a different sort of sacrifice. And when we talk about her story also, like she and the Bad Batch in general are following a very traditional hero's journey monomyth structure, where this whole season, I feel like the end of the second season was that like second threshold part. If you're looking at the wheel of the monomyth, end of season 2 was crossing the second threshold tech dying, and it was a huge turning point, right? And then Omega is captured and she is within a special world, and she then is rescued from without. That's the next stage. And she rescues herself and she brings Crosshair out, right? Mm-hmm. And then I think what we're leading to is this episode, the second episode, episode 11, is the dark night of the soul, this realization, this unbelievable sacrifice that needs to happen. And then that goes to the third threshold, which is the sacrifice, the action, mm-hmm. which is where she then sacrifices herself to go to Mount Tantus in hopes that the Bad Batch will rescue her. And I could have saved this for when we're talking about episode 11, but the point being, this is very much following a hero's journey structure, as most Star Wars stories do.
Yeah.
Right. And I think we're heading towards the climax, the showdown, the catharsis, the resurrection, and the Master of Two Worlds. So where are we going to, like, what boxes are we going to check with those?
Also about, you know, Omega having that, there will also be the destruction of the knowledge of Tantus, as in yep. the what they have been able to figure out, the Empire, as far as what they need to do this cloning, the binding, etc. But that Omega, I think, will have that knowledge herself. And so then she becomes, in a way, a protector of that knowledge and what could happen or what the Empire is truly doing mm-hmm. and will try to do again, as we've discussed with Grogu and everything like that. I gotta say, watching this episode, Identity Crisis, it made me kind of wonder, you know, we've talked a lot about this separation of Omega from the rest of the Bad Batch at the end of the series to go into this next chapter. And if our takeaway from this exposition paragraph from Hemlock is that Omega is not Force sensitive, so then she will not be, I think we had talked about, you know, she goes to learn how to be a Jedi or something like that. If that is kind of off the table, which I think it is, at least for now. Again, ask me next week.
Yeah.
But I when I was watching Identity Crisis, I found myself wondering, I wonder if she'll go off with Emery. Like, if it will be the two of them that go off into this next chapter. Because I think, you know, the reveal of Emery at the end of season two was such a crazy cliffhanger of, oh my God, another girl clone. And then it felt like they really didn't, in the first couple of episodes on Mount Tantus, she wasn't living up to her cliffhanger status. She just kind of seemed like another scientist who Omega had a connection to, wanted there to be something more. It's not until Identity Crisis that I think she's moving into that cliffhanger status that she was at the end of season two. And so it made me kind of wonder, okay, what if the two of them go off to protect this data, to learn more about it, to, I don't know, do something together that only the two of them can do, because they are these female clones. They're both scientists. They've been on Tantus. I don't know. You know, I think that still has to be decided, but it kind of opened up this possibility that maybe they will, that part of Omega's next chapter of her life will involve Emery in a bigger way than I think I was thinking at the beginning of the season.
Yeah, me too. I think that Emery had a lot of moments in this particular episode that you could fully see her doubt, her confusion, and her reluctance, I think, for some of the ways that what she was stepping into mm-hmm. as the new, what is it, chief scientist?
Yeah.
I think even her conversation with Nala Say really yielded a lot of questions. I think the ending of that conversation, which is Emery saying, there's nothing I can do, I don't have that kind of power, and Nala Say saying, don't you, really makes you think mm-hmm. and is sort of foreshadowing to me about where Emery's loyalties lie, because I think she was reluctant to take the baby. She was reluctant, like, she clearly doesn't fit in with the other scientists too. So I don't know, like, her even saying to Hemlock, oh wait, no, her even saying to Nala Say, their children, like I was your plan to discard them too? She already feels that sense of she was discarded. So when you're starting at the place of resentment, there has to be a turning point, right? There has to mm-hmm. be an arc here. And I feel like there's a chance that Emery might be helpful in some way to Omega because of their similarities, like you've outlined.
I think so. I definitely think the identity crisis is Emery's identity crisis.
Yeah, same.
is she going to continue down this path of being the chief scientist, of testing on these children? That line of, was your plan to discard them too? She obviously sees herself in these children, of what's happening to them. I think that's the interpretation, reading between the lines with her conversation with Nala Say. It does. There is still the question of, how was Emery discarded? Was she in a vault like these children? She's obviously older than Omega. So is she an early version of Omega and they weren't getting the blood right? Emery's blood wasn't a binder in the way that Omega's. I do think it's interesting the fact that Emery didn't feel this way about Omega, right? Like, she wanted to keep Omega in Tantus. She actively worked to keep Omega in Tantus. But then when she sees all of these other children in the vault, we start to see her reaction to them change. And maybe it's just that it's fully hitting her of, you know, she obviously didn't know about the vault until this time. So maybe once she's seeing the full extent of what the Empire is doing, she's, you know, starting to put all the pieces together herself and realizing that this is not something she wants to be a part of. And I think that's kind of the conversation she has with Nala Say here. And Nala Say talking about, like, she had to protect Omega because Omega is the key. And Emery is like, well, what about the rest of the kids? Like, you didn't – why would you help Omega and not the rest of them? Mm-hmm. And Nala Say, I think,'s position is she's working within this system in literally an all-controlled prison, like Tantus.
Yeah, like, she doesn't want to be there either.
Yeah, and she's doing, you know, I did what I could. And I love this line of, now they will look to you. What will you do, Emery? And then you already mentioned what Emery responds of, there's nothing I can do. I don't have that kind of power. And Nala says, don't you? And it is, I do think that Emery will be, she will be of help to Omega, the Bad Batch, by the end of this, and the destruction of the vault. And I think we see that through her giving, the fact that she kept the handmade Lula doll from Omega and then gives it, I think the child's name is Eva, she gives it to Eva at the end of the episode. That to me was like, okay, I'm hashtag team Emery now, you know?
Yeah.
And once again, I just like to say, Lula doing a lot of emotional heavy lifting throughout the
from,
season.
From season one.
I know, but it just, it, I guess because she's been there since season one, all of her roles with these different children, we'll talk about her being left at the museum. I'm like, wow, this is serious. The comfort item.
Exactly, the comfort item. So Lula represents comfort, but I think here also Lula represents hope. And it reminds me of how when Rose gives the children in The Last Jedi the rebellion ring that sort of inspires everything. And I think the concept of like Lula being passed down to someone who needs it, who needs hope, who needs comfort, I think is really powerful. And gosh, it really gets me every time. The music also in this episode is unreal.
Yeah. I definitely wanted to call that out. The Kiner family doing God's work once again. It's very similar. It's like that. I would call it like the Tantus theme motif. I'm not sure the proper terminology, but it's very similar to the music we are hearing. And that we discussed in the season premiere of episodes 1 through 3, really episode 1 and 3 on Tantus, that very sciencey, ominous, medical kind of light music in the background that is very creepy and definitely sets the tone for what's going on.
Yeah. Before we move on to episode 11, I want to just talk about how symbolically this episode and the story that it was telling about kids being snatched away from their homes and their families and their parents just for science experiments, which is just devastating. But just the concept of like taking kids away is obviously something that we've seen a lot in Star Wars. And I think something that the Jedi have grappled with sort of, right? But I think that what this as like a, this story is sort of a microcosm about what is going on with Omega too, about how we are thinking about her being removed forcibly from her family, which is the Bad Batch, and how devastating that is. So I think that it's constantly aiding that story too. And it's just, I just think it's quite perfectly fitting into this overall very Omega focused story, despite not being about Omega.
Yeah, I agree. All right, let's really dive into episode 11, Point of No Return. It was directed by Nate Villanueva and written by Amanda Rose Muniz. Once again, I put in our notes, my new enemy slash hero, Amanda. This episode was so angsty and dramatic and amazing. She wrote a couple other episodes earlier this season. I should have pulled them up, but I was kind of surprised actually that she had these two in a row, because I feel like the Bad Batch sometimes it's an every other, or when it's the writers doing multiple episodes in a row, I feel like it's usually someone like Jennifer Corbett, honestly. Mm-hmm. I could be wrong about those stats. It's just kind of what's in my memory about the show. But I thought that Amanda did an incredible job. And one thing I was thinking about when doing the notes is I really wish we got to hear from some of these people, especially the directors like Nate and Saul. They've directed a ton of The Bad Batch, and I just would love to hear from them about their process and the show. And then of course, someone like Amanda for the writers room. I don't know. I would love to hear from them. Especially cause like Nate and Saul, they've directed on other Star Wars shows as well. And anyway, I would just like to know more about them. But this episode is, of course, we finally made it to the attack on Pabu. We have Omega's incredible sacrifice, and a lot was happening in this. This episode felt like an hour long, and I was on the edge of my seat the whole time. Same. I didn't know what was going to happen. I loved how, you know, it's the cat and mouse, I think is how I described it earlier, of not knowing how they were going to get off Pabu, and then they didn't. That's what happens. They didn't. But let's talk about this cold open. And I don't even want to talk about this, but the freaking CX trooper. And I sent Charlotte a voice memo when I was watching this episode, because I watched it before her. And I said, you can't watch this until you've watched the screeners of episode.
You can't listen to this.
Can't listen to this until you've watched episodes 10 and 11. But I said, if this CX trooper is not tech and they have him following Fee, aka his almost girlfriend, I'm going to be so mad. And
I know
the cold open with tech, or with the CX trooper and Fee, I definitely thought that this was going to be the episode of Fee figuring out that she's being followed by the CX trooper. And I wrote the whole episode in my head while I was watching this 2-minute cold open. I was like, and then at the end, Fee's going to reveal she's going to be the one to get the helmet off, and it's going to be tech, and it's going to be perfect because they were, you know, almost together last season. And then,
wow.
Anyway, that's not what this episode ended up being, but I can't, I'm mad at myself for caring about this masked trooper. Mm-hmm. That's where I'm at right now.
I know. Again, flip-flopping constantly whether or not that's tech or not. It's just, I don't even know anymore. Every day it's different. Every day I think something different. So, but like, I'm so with you. Thematically and like story-wise, it kind of makes no sense that we would open here with CX2 going on Fee's ship. Like, I don't know. It's just frustrating. But then also, like, again, story-wise, it would make sense that this Fee would be, like, the last stitch to get to Pabu, because Fee's been to Pabu, showed them Pabu. Like,
yeah.
That makes sense separately, too.
Yeah. Well, we heard the CX trooper in his conversation with Hemlock in Identity Crisis say that he got to the Trend Ocean or something like that, which is Cid. So he got information about Fee from Cid. And then that's how he knew to go to Fee's ship and undo the encryption on her flight log. But anyway, it's one of those things, too. We talked about this in the episode, I can't remember what it's called, but the one where Crosshair has the battle with the CX2 in the water. And we were talking about the symbolism of all of that, obviously the baptism symbolism for Crosshair specifically. But we talked about how there's a new layer on that scene if the CX trooper ends up being tech, and that is who Crosshair was battling that whole time. And I think that goes double for the point of no return and this moment with Fee, that he uses Fee to get the info. If it is tech, you know, obviously there was some heavy flirtation between them. And even the capturing of Omega, the destruction of Pabu, which they talk about as their only home, the first place that felt like home. There's a whole new layer on it if it is tech, who is this CX trooper. But I don't know what I'm going to do if it's not tag.
I know.
I will never care about another new mask side character.
It's not true, Caitlin. You can't say that. You can't say those absolutes because I feel like we've already said that. And yet here we are.
I know. I know. Yeah, I will. Okay. But to further kind of conclude this tech conversation, let's go to Omega leaving the goggles and Lula at the museum. We talked about the museum last week about how if the Empire destroys the museum, I'll be very sad. But we don't see that anyway.
They didn't.
Thank God. But the choice to leave Lula and the goggles, tech's goggles, at the museum, it honestly made me tear up. I think it's a point. Omega leaving Lula behind is such an indicator of her growth, leaving the comfort home, all this, or the comfort item, the symbolism of her, the Marauder eventually being destroyed, of her having to leave Pabu, the place that she considered home, leaving her comfort item there. It's all of this symbolism about growing up and letting go. And in a weird way, I feel like them leaving the goggles feels like a small sign to me too of Tech actually being gone, that we're letting go of that chapter of her life when Lula and someone like Tech was a part of her life, but now they're honored here in the museum on Pabu. So it was a weird moment of the sequence with Fee made me feel like he was definitely alive, but then leaving the goggles felt like, all right, we're closing the door. Omega's letting go of this item that is clearly so symbolic of Tech and leaving it here as she embarks on the next chapter of her life. And that also felt like a, he's really gone. We have to let it go.
I agree with you. But I think leaving something in a museum is different than fully letting something go. And I think letting go would mean like burying it or destroying it or something, but leaving it in a museum to me is, I think that you're right, like symbolically this does represent like moving on, being okay with your, like the comfort item, the home eventually being destroyed, like what's the next step for Omega and everything. But I do think there's something else there as well, of there is some sense of hope that, I don't know,
no,
this remembrance.
I see what you're saying, because Liana even says at the end, you know, it'll be here when you come back.
Exactly.
So the idea that you could give the goggles back to Tech because they're still here. They didn't get destroyed on the Marauder, which is so funny because we talked about this. We were like, Lula's on the Marauder, Gonki's on the Marauder, the goggles are there too. And then
they addressed it all.
They were like, don't worry. You don't have to worry,
don't worry about
this.
About it. No Gonki, no goggles, no Lula. You're totally
fine. You're fine. Yeah.
And I think that just based off of that, it's like, okay, no, we can return to this later for another story point.
Yeah.
It's not fully letting go. It's letting go in this moment, which is good and good for Omega's character and good for us to understand like when the home does blow up, because that is helpful like for plot reasons. But I don't think it's fully letting go of hope, I guess, about Tech. And I don't think that's exactly what Omega's doing, but I think this is mainly for the audience.
Yeah, I think it's kind of twofold, because specifically with Lula, you know, Omega's in a place at the beginning of the season where she needs that comfort item to the point that she recreates it as something to hold on to. But then here in what is arguably, you know, obviously before she knows what's going to happen the rest of the episode and eventually sacrificing herself, but for her to realize she doesn't need it in the same way she did at the beginning of the season, I think is also symbolic of her growth. And then, of course, the decision she makes by the end to sacrifice herself too. But that's a very grown-up decision. And so her leaving the comfort item is symbolic of that. And I agree. The fact that they're not destroyed, that we can come back to them, is important. But I think that's important for the story reason. I think for Omega specifically, it is symbolic of letting go, of just, you know, again, moving into the next stage of her life.
Definitely. Okay, so Pabu is destroyed. How are you feeling? Obviously, you're sad. We've discussed.
I'm feeling so sad. The shot of the Imperial ship over Pabu, we knew it was coming. I was a wreck, though, and visually having the spotlights all over the planet from the Imperial ships and the stormtroopers and clones and things like that, and it's meant to be such a departure and a contrast to you know, the usual soft sunsets and like lovely lighting we usually see here. So it just, you know, it sucked.
Yep. It really does suck.
And the thing is, too, this episode feels so big that it almost feels hard to talk about because
– Totally. I was just thinking that, too.
Because I'm like, there's so many, like, little things that I think were so well done in – throughout this entire episode. But it's like the takeaway, right, that I think we should just talk about, and then we can add our kind of throwaways of random bits we want to discuss. But let's go to Crosshair and Omega, because mm-hmm. this is really the meat of what is happening, is the fact that Omega makes the decision to sacrifice herself. And I think this is a good conversation to read out. So they're Crosshair and Omega are hiding. Of course, it comes down to Crosshair and Omega. She didn't go with Hunter. Wrecker, of course, was taken out, but he's okay. His vitals are stable. He's okay. And, you know, when they're initially starting to run, Omega says to Hunter and Crosshair, "This is all my fault." And Hunter, in a lovely little moment, gets down at her level and says, "This is not your fault. Stay focused on the mission. This is the Empire's fault." And then later, after Hunter has been in a crazy scene when he's in that Imperial airship and CX
– Oh, my gosh.
CX-2 shoots the pilot. Oh, my God.
There was a lot of, like, just to take a step back, there was a lot of action set pieces that were – so many things were happening around this, like, one mountainous island yeah. that I just – was thinking about all the different storyboards that they were doing for this and sort of the logistical timeline of how they were going to tell the story. It seems very complicated, and I just have to give the writers some props there mm-hmm. because I feel like all of that was done in such an efficient way that really built so much tension. But then also I had a clear sense of place about what was happening where, which is really yeah. hard to do.
Yeah.
And it was really good. It was just really great action. And as critiquers of action scenes in terms of sometimes they're like bang, bang, shoot 'em up. No, everything here had a purpose. It was all economized and it was all devastating.
Well, it helps because we're familiar with this place and yes. we have been there enough that we understand the geography a little bit more. And it's not just this random planet that, you know, like in the Clone Wars, you just kind of would end up on a planet and you start fighting back and forth. And usually Obi-Wan is trying to tell Anakin where to go. And I'm sitting there like, where even are okay. we?
Yeah.
But
and that's why some of the most effective stories in the Clone Wars that like some of the more dramatic pieces happen in places that we were aware of or we understood the geography about because, you know, mm-hmm. like,
yeah,
I don't know. Yeah, or they do harder. A really good job of storytelling that we know the sense of place. Yeah. And I know that they built it all out, you know,
They planned this. They had a plan. They planned this.
Yeah.
Okay. So, Crosshair and Omega finally go back into Shep's house where they're hiding. They're trying to figure out a plan. And Omega says, "There's no hiding, Crosshair. The Empire knows I'm here. They won't stop searching until they find me. Our only choice is to let them capture me." And Crosshair says, "What? You'll be taken back to Tantus." And she says, "Exactly. We've been trying to get those coordinates and nothing's worked. But if I keep my calm on me and turn myself over, you can track me to Tantus. This is our chance to finally rescue the clones imprisoned there." Crosshair says, "No, they'll search you and find it. It won't work." "Well, then shoot a secondary tracker onto the ship that they take me away on." And Crosshair says, "There's too many unknown variables. It's not a viable plan." And Omega says, "It's all we've got and it's my choice." Crosshair just says, "Omega." And then she says, "Focus on the bigger mission, Crosshair. I'm just a small part of it." This, I was crying. This literally broke me. This last line of "focus on the bigger mission, Crosshair. I'm just a small part of it." I also sent this in a voice memo to Charlotte where I said, I feel like Omega and Nemec would be friends. There's just a similar vibe in how they're thinking about things. And it's true. She's just a small part of it. This is the way to solve the problem of finding out where Tantus is. And she knows it. But then you know that Crosshair, of course, doesn't want her to do this. And I just love the parallel of Hunter telling Omega to stay focused on the mission of – for Hunter, it's the mission of escape. But Omega is looking at the bigger picture. And then she also says it back to Crosshair of, "You need to stay focused, Crosshair. This is why Pabu is being destroyed, is because of me. But what we're doing is bigger than me. And I have to do this." And it just, the fact that she made this choice, and she even says to Crosshair, "It's my choice. This is what we're doing." again, the letting go of the comfort item to her making this decision, it's all connected in her growing up, of her realizing what her purpose is. And I just thought it was such a beautiful, beautiful, horrible scene.
Totally. But it's all focused to me on the fact that this conversation had to be with Crosshair and not Wrecker, yeah. not Hunter, no one else, because Crosshair knows the magnitude of what it would mean to go back to Tantus and to give yourself up for the Empire. Yeah. He knows it better than anyone there. And he also has gone on a journey for this entire season of understanding loyalty to his brothers, and also understanding that there is a greater plan for them, that they need to help others. It's not just about themselves. It's not just about their unit. It's about everything else. But I think that there's so much drama here in the fact that there was issues about Crosshair rejoining the Bad Batch, and what in the fact that Wrecker, which, oh my God, Wrecker's like knocked out in the back, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe okay, maybe not. And he's, I think that there's no one in this room with them to overhear the fact that Crosshair let Omega go.
Yeah.
And Crosshair is already seen, I think, from the outside as like, can he be trusted? Can he not be? So what is the situation going to be like when everyone else realizes that Crosshair was the one that let her go? Mm-hmm. I just generally feel like it makes the most sense story-wise and tension-wise for it to come down to Crosshair and Omega to have this conversation, because they're truly the only ones that really fully understand the magnitude of it. Mm-hmm. And Crosshair accepting that Omega has to go, I don't think he would have done this like even three episodes ago. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but I think that it's very clear that the conversation had to be between Crosshair and Omega here.
Yeah, exactly. Because I think we know that Hunter would never approve of this plan. Crosshair even says this in the beginning when they come back into the house and Omega says, what are we going to do? And Crosshair says, Hunter would want us to stick to the plan. And Omega's like, that's ridiculous. That plan's not working. This is what we're going to do.
When have we ever followed orders?
God bless. I can't. I think you're right. It's important that it is Crosshair that's having this, because there is the tension with, you know, everyone else about, you know, his loyalties. But also, to your point, he knows just how monumental this sacrifice is. I'm honestly surprised a little bit that he didn't put up more of a fight to Omega about
this. I think he's beaten down. Everyone is, I mean, they're in this enclosed room sort of.
Yeah.
Like, what is going to happen? Pabu around them is being absolutely destroyed. Wrecker is knocked out. Like, they couldn't have more odds stacked against them, that there really is no other choice.
Yeah.
Right. And Batcher's even gone. Like,
I know. It's serious.
It's very, very serious. Like, Crosshair sort of has no choice. Like, the fact that we're getting now to this sacrifice, there's an acceptance of the sacrifice needs to happen, even though it hurts so much.
Yeah.
And I think that Omega also has, this is what's absolutely devastating, Omega has so much confidence in Crosshair being able to shoot a tracker on the ship, and he misses the shot.
As soon as she said, then shoot a secondary tracker onto my ship, we've been talking about this all season of how the moment Crosshair has to make the shot is going to be a moment for Omega. And when she said this, I was like, this is it. And to me, it was all clicking into place. I did not anticipate Crosshair missing the shot.
Me neither. I was like, no, he's going to get the shot. It's going to be fine.
And I was like, this is it. This is the
because
moment.
We have confidence, just like Omega does, in Crosshair in this moment. But we don't. If the tremor and the missing of the shot represents Crosshair's own trauma, it's coming up to the surface again.
Because
it's bubbling up the nerves. Because. Exactly.
I was like, this is it. This is him gonna make the shot. He's gonna make the shot. They're gonna follow her to Tantus. It's gonna be fine. And then he misses the shot. I literally could not believe that he missed the shot. It was baffling to me. This is why I had to pause before I went into episode 12, because he missed the shot. And I keep saying that, but he missed the shot. And I can't believe it. And I think it's also worth noting that Crosshair, in the beginning of The Harbinger, he's the one that says, "What does it matter about the M count? We're not giving her up anyway." He's the one that said that. And then, of course, he's the one that's with her when the plan to give herself up is happened.
And then he's the one to miss the shot.
He missed the shot. It was so dramatic. It was so intense. I think it's one of the best episodes of The Bad Batch in total, I think. Absolutely incredible attention. The music when Crosshair is getting beat up by the clone troopers, the stormtroopers, when he's trying to make the shot, was so intense and good. The Kyners really knocked it out of the park, as they always do. But it brought it to a whole new level for me. I think it was perfect. I will say I had one critique, though. And my one critique is that I wish Crosshair had taken off his helmet when he realizes he missed the shot, so that we could see the expression on his face. We see him sigh, and the subtitles even say sigh. But I think it would have been better to see him take off the helmet to realize that he, and see the realization on his face that he missed it, and that Omega was counting on him to make the shot and he didn't. And we flash back to Omega in the ship, and she is confident that he's gotten it, that he's got her. And he doesn't. They're right back where they started, with no intel on Tantus, and now Omega is gone.
I agree with you about that, but I also kind of like that there was an ambiguity there about what, like, leaving to your imagination about his devastated face. I think it might have been a little, like, Mickey Mousey if we did see his face.
I don't think so.
Yeah, it probably would have been fine, but I also get the choice to have him masked.
Yeah.
I think Star Wars just does a good job of us feeling emotions through masks, mm-hmm. and mask acting, which I know this is animated, but same thing.
Yeah.
And I felt it. I felt this confusion. And I think that there was a vagueness that was left that I think was needed as we see Omega's confidence, right? Like, we know that Crosshair wasn't confident in that moment.
Yeah.
And I think that's all we needed to know. And then we contrast that with Omega's own confidence when she's inside the ship.
Yeah.
And she, you know, takes a look back, doesn't see anyone, and still is confident.
Goodness gracious.
Goodness gracious me. It's wild. This episode was such a journey. Also, I was when we haven't, like, spent enough time on this. When Wrecker got hurt, our conversation about, like, who we would be the most
don't
sad
bring it up again.
From the Bad Batch died. And I remember being like, if they do anything to Wrecker, like, it's over. And then they did something to Wrecker, and I was like, how dare they?
AZ said he was unconscious, but his vitals are stable. Yeah, that was all I needed.
Right. I was in peril a little bit there, but then it was like, okay, I think he's going to be okay. His work will be okay. I think they also, story-wise, had to take him out just based off of, like, his just general power and ability to take things down, right? They needed the destruction of Pabu to be as devastating as possible. Mm-hmm. And when you have, like, a man of super strength there, maybe that's not needed.
Well,
you know?
Yeah, and the CX2... he says we've taken out the other two clones, but there's still one that's with her. So it's about really, again, it's Crosshair who has to be left with her. So you got to take out everyone else. So Wrecker is out, Hunter is out, it's just Crosshair left. And they eventually get to him after she's already given herself up, and it's part of why he doesn't make the shot. So yeah, they had to take him out. They had to take them both out.
Jeez Louise.
I will say it was nice. I was sad that we've never really been to this wonderful open air market that they have at the top of Pabu. People having snacks. I was like, again, just a fantastic place to live. We finally get to see the teenage clones that were brought there, and Shep and Liana. I was very happy. I will say I loved the design of the outfits that the teenage clones were wearing.
Yeah.
I can't remember all their names. I'm sorry. I think one is named Dex. I thought they looked so great. Very fashionable. But yeah, I was really glad to see Shep and Liana. One critique I would say is I feel like we should have seen all of these people before this moment, given how often we've been here. And agreed. It would have been great to see Omega talk to her friend Liana, get to know these other clones who are in a more similar stage of life to her. You know what I mean? But it was nice to see them.
Fully agree. Anyway, what a two-episode pair. Something interesting that Joel Aaron said on Twitter was that the lighting vibe for the two episodes, the first one was cold and the second one was hot. And yeah, doesn't that sum up the vibe of these, like, the identity crisis was very chilling and the point of no return was intense, mm-hmm. fiery, hot. I think that it's very clear. Opposites. It's always interesting when we have a double episode two and having these two together. I think that this was a smart choice, by the way, to pair these together. But I think that, I don't know, I like to compare them or I think about them as a pair. And I think that this hot and cold discussion really works here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I totally agree. Just... I honestly could have seen these two episodes being like a season finale. You know, we're talking about the hero's journey and the crossing of the third threshold. They could have just fully ended the season here. Obviously, that's not what we're doing. We know that this is the series finale for season three as a total, and there's still a good number of episodes left. But that's how intense it was. And that is just a peek at what is coming for the rest of the season and the series. So I just think these were excellent, excellent episodes, some of the best The Bad Batch has ever done. And I'm still honestly kind of recovering. When I went to go back to watch these to do our show notes, I was like, okay, let's get emotionally.
I was kind of dreading it,
let's
honestly,
get emotionally ready.
Dreading is probably the wrong word, but I was not emotionally ready. Mm-hmm. And I was like really excited to go through and write the notes and everything. But then I was just had to get into the headspace of here's what we're going to see and this is going to be a lot.
Yeah, I remember I was writing down the transcribing Crosshair and Omega's conversation and I was like, I just need to watch it through again before I start transcribing it because it just sucks you in to the drama of it. And yeah, it's just incredible, incredible work. And The Bad Batch continues to be super emotional for Charlotte and I. And yeah, I'm really excited to see where it all ends up.
Same. Same.
All right. Well, is there anything else we want to, any other little tidbits or anything else we want to discuss from these two episodes?
I think that's it for me.
I think so too. Well, thank you guys so much for listening. As always, we hope you enjoyed this discussion. Please let us know what you thought. You can find us on Twitter, X at SkyTalkersPod, or our personal handles. Charlotte's is at Clarity and mine is at Caitlin Plesher. We also have our website, skytalkers.com, our Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, email, all really good places to find us. And if you have a couple seconds and would like to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, we would really appreciate it. And if you want to share more that you're listening to the show in real time, you can take a screenshot, post it to your story page, whatever social media platform of choice, tag us, and we would love to reshare that as well. And if you want to get involved in our Discord community and find out other ways to support us, you can head on over to our Patreon and check out our different reward tiers there.
And I want to say a huge thank you to these patrons: Rachel, Sarah, Shelby, Cherie, Sophie, Stephanie, Stuart, Suki, Susanna, Thomas, Tim, Z, Aaron, Adam, Alex, Alexa, Anna, Anders, Arzu, Aubrey, Becky, Ben, Blastpoints, John, Joey, and James. Thank you so much for supporting us.
Yes, thank you guys so much. And until next time, may the Force be with you.
May the Force be with you.